Parental guidance is advised. We're dealing with some difficult subject matter, perhaps some would not want their children to be here. At any rate, we're going to deal with it. This is a photo of the Joe Paterno statue, which is outside of Penn State University, or should I say it was outside Penn State University. And it turns out, according to Louis Free, who is the former FBI director who was hired by Penn State to investigate certain events at Penn State University over the years, it turns out that Joe Paterno, the legendary football coach, and many other people at Penn State University were involved in hushing up allegations against former football coach Jerry Sandusky, who was involved in abusing young men and children, that all of these people were involved in hushing up these allegations, which allowed Sandusky to continue to prey on certain young men. Here's what Free said. The most powerful men at Penn State failed to take any steps for 14 years to protect the children who Sandusky victimized. And after Free issued his report, the president of the university issued an order, and this is what happened. The statue of Joe Paterno, who himself died a few months earlier, was carried off like a dead body. Many have wondered, how could Joe Paterno have allowed something like this to take place under his watch? He was reputed to be a man of integrity. He ran a squeaky clean and highly successful program for decades. And yet, if we are to believe this report, he hushed up these allegations against Sandusky, which allowed Sandusky to continue to prey on young men. These sorts of cover-ups are all too common in our world, including and especially by people of good repute, like Paterno. They are so common, in fact, that we have to ask ourselves, is there something within us that would cover up wrongdoing? Is there something within us, as opposed to pointing fingers at Paterno, yes, he deserves rebuke, but is there something within us that would cover up wrongdoing to protect ourselves in some way? We're coming now to Judges chapter 19. You can turn there if you will. We will also have the text appearing behind me on the screen. Many are shocked to find this chapter in the Holy Bible because it deals with some very difficult stuff, and we may want to recoil from it. In fact, we rightly do recoil from it. We should be shocked by these events. And yet we need Judges 19. We need a slap in the face, so to speak. We need a dose of reality to understand the reality of the darkness that is happening in our world. Because it is what happens here in Judges 19 is happening today in our world. And therefore, we as followers of Jesus need to know about it. We need to be aware of it so that we can pierce the darkness with the gospel. Our story today features a Levite. If you were with us last week, you remember that last week's story also featured a Levite. This is a different Levite. The last Levite didn't fare so well, at least from God's perspective. He was an idolater, and he sold himself out for the highest bidder, and so he does not come off well at all. And so now we hear of another Levite, and we wonder, okay, is this man going to redeem his tribe? The Levites were from the tribe, the priestly tribe, and they were supposed to be teachers of the law. They were supposed to be shepherds in Israel. Is this Levite going to redeem the name of his tribe? Judges chapter 19, first of all, verses 1 through 10. In those days, Israel had no king. Now a Levite who lived in a remote area in the hill country of Ephraim took a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. But she was unfaithful to him, literally, most likely, according to scholars, she was angry. She was angry with him. Turns out she was angry with cause, most likely. She left him and went back to her father's house in Bethlehem, Judah. After she had been there 4 months, her husband went to her to persuade her to return. He had with him his servant and 2 donkeys. She took him into her father's house, and when her father saw him, he gladly welcomed him. His father-in-law, the girl's father, prevailed upon him to stay. So he remained with him 3 days, eating and drinking and sleeping there. On the 4th day, they got up early, and he prepared to leave. But the girl's father said to his son-in-law, "Refresh yourself with something to eat. Then you can go." So the two of them sat down to eat and drink together. Afterward, the girl's father said, "Please stay tonight and enjoy yourself." And when the man got up to go, his father-in-law persuaded him, so he stayed there that night. On the morning of the 5th day, when he rose to go, the girl's father said, "Refresh yourself. Wait till afternoon." So the two of them ate together. Then when the man with his concubine and his servant got up to leave, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said, "Now look, it's almost evening. Spend the night here. The day is nearly over. Stay and enjoy yourself. Early tomorrow morning, you can get up and be on your way home." But unwilling to stay another night, the man left and went toward Jebus, that is, Jerusalem, with his 2 saddled donkeys and his concubine. Our text begins by saying that there was no king in Israel. There was no divine king, most importantly, because the Israelites had thrown over Yahweh, their Lord, in order to do whatever was right in their own eyes. And that's the story of the book of Judges. That's the story in this case as well. Everyone does what is right in their own eyes because they are not submitting to the king. Now, this particular Levite has a concubine. That would be a sexual partner. They would not be married per se officially. This is a sexual partner, a sort of a marriage of convenience, but not an official marriage. And at some point, for some reason, undisclosed reason, she becomes angry with him, and she leaves. She returns home to Bethlehem. And we can see here our map. They were residing in Ephraim. She returned to Bethlehem, and then her partner, the Levite, goes in pursuit after her in order to win her back. He misses her, apparently. It's been 4 months, and he really wants to have her back. So he makes this journey from Ephraim to Bethlehem in order to win back his woman. He gets to Bethlehem, and the father of the woman pours on this hospitality. He's very excited to see him. We don't know exactly why, but we know that hospitality is highly valued in that culture. And so he pours on the hospitality, and eventually the Levite wants to leave but can't seem to extricate himself. Perhaps you found yourself in a similar situation where you really wanted to leave and you couldn't quite leave. That's the case for the Levite in this case. Eventually, he manages to extricate himself, but the problem is if he doesn't stay in Bethlehem, where is he going to stay? By the time he leaves, it is late in the day. Judges chapter 19, verse 11. When they were near Jebus, and the day was almost gone, the servant said to his master, "Come, let's stop at this city of the Jebusites and spend the night." His master replied, "No, we won't go into an alien city whose people are not Israelites. We will go on to Gibeah." He added, "Come, let's try to reach Gibeah or Ramah and spend the night in one of those places." So they went on, and the sun set as they neared Gibeah in Benjamin. There they stopped to spend the night. They went and sat in the city square, but no one took them into his home for the night. That evening, an old man from the hill country of Ephraim, who was living in Gibeah, the men of that place were Benjamites, came in from his work in the fields. When he looked and saw the traveler in the city square, the old man asked, "Where are you going? Where did you come from?" He answered, "We are on our way from Bethlehem to Judah to a remote area in the hill country of Ephraim where I live. I have been to Bethlehem in Judah, and now I am going to the house of the Lord. No one has taken me into his house. We have both straw and fodder for our donkeys, and bread and wine for ourselves, your servants, me, your maidservant, and the young man with us. We don't need anything." In other words, we're not going to be an inconvenience. "You are welcome at my house," the old man said. "Let me supply whatever you need. Only don't spend the night in the square." So he took him into his house and fed his donkeys. After they had washed their feet, they had something to eat and drink. So they depart from Bethlehem, and they're on their way to Jebus, and the servant says, hey, let's stay in Jebus. Later it becomes Jerusalem once the Israelites possess it, but right now it's a pagan city. And the Levite says, no, we can't go there. That's a pagan city. They don't believe in our God. We are going to bypass that. Let's see if we can press all the way on and make it to Gibeah. And then you can see from the map here where they go. So they go on to Gibeah, and Gibeah is an Israelite town. It belongs to the tribe of Benjamin, so they expect to receive favorable treatment in Gibeah, but not in Jebus. But the people of Gibeah refuse to take this party in. They make themselves available. They make themselves aware of what they are doing. They're sitting in the public square, but nobody takes notice of them. Nobody takes them in. Eventually, this old man who comes in from the fields, this old man who also hails from Ephraim, so there's a connection. The Levite is from Ephraim. This particular old man is from Ephraim. He comes in from the fields. He notices what's going on, and he comes to the rescue of the Levite and his party, and he takes them in, and the Levite and the old man enjoy themselves in our next sequence, at least at the beginning. Judges chapter 19, verse 22. While they were enjoying themselves, some of the wicked men of the city surrounded the house. Pounding on the door, they shouted to the old man who owned the house, "Bring out the man who came to your house so that we can have sex with him." The owner of the house went outside and said to them, "No, my friends, don't be so vile. Since this man is my guest, don't do this disgraceful thing. Look, here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. I will bring them out to you now, and you can use them and do to them whatever you wish. But to this man, don't do such a disgraceful thing." But the men would not listen to him. So the man took his concubine, the Levite took his concubine and sent her outside to them, and they raped her and abused her throughout the night, and at dawn they let her go. At daybreak, the woman went back to the house where her master was staying, fell down at the door, and lay there until daylight. So certain men from this town in Gibeah realize that strangers and visitors have come, and they come to the door, and what do they want? They want to have sex with the Levite. They want to have sex with the man. They probably want to rape him, is what they actually want to do. And this old man pleads with them. Don't do such a vile thing. You can't even think about such a thing. However, unspeakably, he offers them his virgin daughter. And he also offers the concubine as well. And we ask ourselves, what kind of father is this? What kind of father would offer up his daughter to wolfish men like this? And what kind of hospitality is this? This woman has come under his house. This is a culture that values hospitality. And now he's going to take this woman, offer to take this woman, and throw the concubine to the wolves as well. Well, the key to understanding this man's actions, that being the old man's action, is the words, this man, in reference to the Levite. He talks about the Levite being this man. Don't do this vile thing to this man. This man. He is concerned for this particular man. Not for the women in the house. What's going on here? He is concerned for his own reputation as a host, and this is a man's world, a host for men. And he doesn't care for the women, and he doesn't even care for his own daughter in comparison to this Levite, who is, of course, a man. And what of the Levite? The Levite then decides to intervene, not by getting in the way of evil, but by taking his woman and throwing his own woman to these men, and these men are so ravenous that they earlier wanted the man, but now they'll take the woman, and they take her. And they take her, and they take her. And when they are through with her, they discard her like she is a piece of trash. At dawn, she manages to make her way back to the doorway where she lay, and no one bothers to check on her. No one from inside the house bothers to check on her. And by the way, men, if there is a bullet to be taken, if evil is coming your way or coming some way, and there's a bullet to be taken, you get in the way of it. Do not let the woman take the bullet. Do not let the children take the bullet. They are weaker, they are more vulnerable, physically speaking. Men, you get in the way of evil. I hope that is not chauvinistic and chivalrous, but chivalrous, and I hope chivalrous is good. Men, you take the bullet. Well, in our text, morning breaks. Judges chapter 19, verse 27. When her master got up in the morning and opened the door of the house and stepped out to continue on his way, there lay his concubine, fallen in the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. He said to her, "Get up, let's go." But there was no answer. Then the man put her on his donkey and set out for home. So the Levite now gets up. Wait a minute. He was lying down. He threw his woman to these men, and then he went in and he lied down. He went to sleep. That's exactly what the narrator is saying. Chilling callousness. He doesn't care at all. And then when he gets up and he goes outside, he sees that this woman has been is lying on the doorway with her hands on the threshold, as if she were reaching out for help to someone inside, but no help is forthcoming. And when he speaks to her, there is not a single word of concern, only words concerning the timing of their departure. Hey, let's get going. We got to get going. We got a schedule to keep. Let's be on our way. That's the only thing he says to the woman. He is only concerned for himself and the timing of his departure. When he speaks to the woman is unable to respond. Is she unconscious? Is she dead? We don't know. The narrator doesn't tell us. Perhaps the narrator doesn't even know. At any rate, what does the man do, the Levite? He picks up this woman and throws her onto the donkey as if she were nothing more than a bundle so that he could be on his way. What kind of man is this? He's a Levite. He's supposed to represent his tribe. This is the priestly tribe in Israel. These are supposed to be the law keepers, the law teachers. These are the shepherds in Israel. And what are shepherds supposed to do? They are supposed to lay down their lives for the sheep. What does this shepherd do? He takes his lamb and he throws her to wolfish men in order for him to return to from where he came. Judges chapter 19, verse 29. When he reached home, he took a knife and cut up his concubine limb by limb into 12 parts and sent them into all the areas of Israel. Everyone who saw it said, "Such a thing has never been seen or done, not since the day the Israelites came up out of Egypt. Think about it. Consider it. Tell us what to do." And we see from our map that his journey comes full circle. He left Ephraim in the first place to go to Bethlehem to retrieve his concubine. That's what he does. And finally, he returns to Ephraim, but not, of course, as he intended, because he has this concubine who is either unconscious or dead. We don't know which. What is left for him to do at this point except for what? Cut her up into 12 different pieces and send those pieces throughout Israel, apparently to the 12 tribes of Israel? It's almost as if she is nothing more than a carcass. And the narrator leaves open the possibility that she is actually still alive when he does this. And then sending these pieces of her body throughout Israel, what's he doing? This is a call to arms. You should be offended by this, all of Israel. You should do something about this. You should punish the men of Gibeah for what has taken place here. That's what's going on by sending the body parts throughout all of Israel. And in the next chapter, we'll look at it next week, we'll see how Israel responds to this call to arms. So the Levite, does he redeem the name of his tribe? Hardly. And what of the Levites in the book of Israel? They're supposed to be the shepherds. What's going on with them? They fail Israel. Everyone does what is right in their own eyes, including the Levites. What of the shepherds of Israel? I am reminded of this Bob Dylan song, "Ring Them Bells." Oh, the shepherd is asleep where the willows weep and the mountains are filled with lost sheep. Well, having concluded concluding Judges 19, we might be reminded of Genesis 19. That's the story of Sodom. And Lot was there, and two visitors came to him there, and the men of Sodom, or certain men of Sodom, wanted to have sex with the two visitors. In that case, the atrocity was averted because the two visitors turned out to be angels. But remember, the Levite bypassed the pagan city, Jebus, to get to the Israelite city, Gibeah. And what does he find when he gets to the Israelite city, Gibeah? Gibeah, a town in Israel, has become the new Sodom. That's one of the points of this story, how far things have fallen in the nation of Israel. And who are the people in this story, by the way? We don't get one single name. We don't know what their names are. Perhaps the narrator doesn't know what their names are. At any rate, he doesn't give us their names. And what does it mean to have no name? Well, they have names, of course, but their names aren't reported. But to be human is to have a name, is to have an identity. The first thing you find out about somebody is their name. To be human is to have a name. To not have a name is almost to be inhuman. And if you're a man in this story and you don't have a name, you can do whatever you want. If you're a woman in this story and you don't have a name, you become an object, and the men can do to you as they please. I'm reminded of the movie The Shawshank Redemption. There's a certain prisoner there by the name of Haywood, and he is complicit in the death of another prisoner. And the next day, he is asked about the death of that particular prisoner, and he is asked, what was his name? And he takes umbrage, Haywood does, and says, it doesn't matter what his name was. See, if it doesn't matter what his name was, then it doesn't matter whether Haywood is complicit in the death of that prisoner. In a world in which there is no king, in a world in which we have thrown over the divine king, in a world in which we do what is right in our own eyes, in that world will produce a certain number of sexual predators and sex traffickers. And in such a world, women and children are especially vulnerable. And there are in this world some fathers, like the old man of Gibeah, who will actually offer up their daughters or their children to sex traffickers in order to make ends meet or to spice up their lives with a little alcohol. There are some people in this world, like the Levite, who would condemn such atrocities, who would condemn sexual abuse, who would condemn rape, and yet they would deny complicity in creating and perpetuating the environment in which such atrocities take place, the sexually explicit environment, the violent environment in which such atrocities take place. You might think of certain films which glorify violence and objectify women. You might think of certain video games which do the same. You might think of certain songs which glorify violence and objectify women. That's the environment in which we live. We shouldn't be surprised by certain atrocities that almost mimic what takes place in what we see and hear in our culture. Many in our world will turn a blind eye to sexual abuse. Why? Why are so many people oblivious to obvious signs of sexual abuse? Because many of us are preoccupied with our own affairs, because we don't want to get involved, because we see what we want to see, or we don't see what we don't want to see. Why are so many people reticent to report allegations of sexual abuse? Some are interested in protecting a certain reputation of a family, of an institution, or whatever. The man in this story, the old man, was interested, apparently, in protecting his reputation as a host of men. The report concerning Penn State said that those men who covered up those allegations did so because they were interested in protecting the reputation of the university and the reputation of the football program. They didn't want bad publicity, so they covered up the allegations. Some are interested in self-preservation, like the Levite. Some would simply continue on their way in the instance of sexual abuse. They would continue on their way, like the Levite, and say perhaps to some victim, get up, let's get going. You gotta get moving, you gotta put this behind you, and don't talk about it anymore, just put it behind you. That's the advice that some victims of sexual abuse get in this world. Now, the inclination to cover up wrongdoing is by no means limited to incidents of sexual abuse. It's in many of us. Many of us are interested, unfortunately, in covering up wrongdoing. Is there something that you're covering up right now? Why are you covering up? What might you be inclined to cover up? And for what reason would you cover it up? Are you interested in protecting a reputation of some sort? The reputation of a family, the reputation of an institution, the reputation of something else? Are you interested in keeping up appearances, saving face, looking good? Do you really want to stay uninvolved? That's somebody else's business. You want to distance yourself. You don't want to make waves. You don't want to ruffle feathers. You don't want to disturb the status quo. Listen to the Apostle Paul in Ephesians chapter 5, verses 11 through 14. Have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. For it is shameful even to mention what the disobedient do in secret. But everything exposed by the light becomes visible, for it is light that makes everything visible. Have nothing to do with the deeds of darkness, but rather expose them by the way that you live, by the righteous way that you live, yes, but also, on occasion, if necessary, speaking up. Calling out evil, saying that's evil, that's unjust, that's not right. What do you do then? Well, in doing so, what you're doing is you're helping to rescue the victims and you're calling the perpetrators to account. And even there are some of those out there who carry out such atrocities who actually don't want to be doing this. They've trapped themselves in this. So when bringing things to light, then you have the tendency to help rescue even the perpetrators. Punish them, yes, but ultimately they get freedom because they're not hiding anymore. Many of those in our world who are victims of sexual abuse have no voice. They're quiet. They remain silent. Like this woman who was unconscious or dead, she didn't speak. She had no voice. Some victims of sexual abuse simply don't understand what's happened to them. So they remain silent. Many of them feel dirty because of what's happened to them, so they remain silent. Many of them, in some strange way, feel responsible for what has happened to them, so they remain silent. Some of them have been threatened if they say anything about it. The perpetrator has threatened them, or family members or other people complicit with the perpetrator have threatened them if they speak up, so they remain silent. So we can't hear them. We can't hear their silent cries. But perhaps we can become aware of them, as if they were draped across our doorways, so to speak, as if their hands were reaching out to us. We don't know their names, but surely they have names. And what do? If we're followers of Jesus, we bring the gospel to the world. We pierce the darkness with the gospel. That is the restorative justice of God, which calls evil to account and offers hope and salvation for victims and ultimately even for perpetrators, yes. But we call evil to account, we bring the gospel to the world, we bring our lives to the world, we pierce the darkness with the light of the gospel. What does that mean? Four things. Abandon self-interest. Stand up to evil. Speak up for victims. Pray like crazy. Abandon self-interest. That's something that these men didn't do in this story. Stand up to evil. They didn't do it either. Speak up for victims. No one spoke up for this woman. Pray like crazy. Nobody prayed. Bring the gospel to the world. Bring the light of the gospel to the world. Bring God's justice to the world. After all, we don't remember the city of Bethlehem because of the book of Judges. We remember the city of Bethlehem because of the Gospel of Luke. In the book of Judges, a man and a woman have this illicit sort of relationship. The woman leaves. The man makes this journey from Ephraim to Bethlehem in order to retrieve her. In the Gospel of Luke, there's a man and there's a woman, and they live in Nazareth. They have no sexual relationship, and yet they journey from Nazareth to Bethlehem, where what happens? The woman astoundingly gives birth to a son. She gives birth to the Son of God. She gives birth to the human and divine King. God pierced the darkness with the light on that night, and he is piercing it still. He is piercing it through those of us who are following Jesus. He is piercing it through those of us who are taking the love and the healing justice of God to the world. And one day, the light will completely overwhelm the darkness. For Jesus is the light who shines in the darkness. Finally, if you have been a victim of sexual abuse, and if you've not told anybody about this, we would encourage you to do so. All of our pastors, all of our elders are available to listen to you, and we will be committed to getting you the kind of help that you need to help deal with whatever you have gone through. Second of all, I'm very encouraged to report that there are many of you in this congregation who are taking this issue to heart and are serving the Lord, are bringing the gospel to the world. I would simply like to highlight three individuals and three ministries that you could possibly consider getting involved in if this issue concerns you. Benita Thompson, who is one of our missionaries, runs the Home of New Beginnings in Bangkok, Thailand, and this is a ministry that helps women who are involved in the sex industry there. Sophia Cedillo has emerged from our congregation, has grown up here, and she serves with International Justice Mission in Washington, D.C. And finally, Brian and Angela Woe, who you'll hear from in a minute, who are involved with the Bay Area Anti-Trafficking Coalition, and you can get involved with them as well. All of this contact information, by the way, is listed on the sermon notes.